rock solid, and that's this relationship. Now, where does that come from? Your hormones? Your feelings? No, it comes from the will. It truly is that part of love that is a decision. And yet, once again, I can't tell you how many couples have come into my counseling office and said, hey, doc, we've lost that love and feeling. What they really mean is we don't understand commitment. We didn't know this was part of the thing. We just thought these feelings would kind of fuel the commitment and it would stay there. And all this other stuff is gone, and it seems like the commitment has faded away too, you know? Well, the truth is, the point of all this research that was done at Yale University was to say this. Love, this is the bottom line, love is very fluid. If you're taking notes, write that down. Love is very fluid. Love isn't a static thing that you fall into and you fall out of. Love is this thing that changes, and there's an ebb and flow to it, and there's seasons to it, and it seems to, over time, become something different than it used to be, and it'll be something different down the road than it is now. Love is always changing. It is very, very fluid. In fact, I often tell couples that I'm working with that are engaged to be married, I will tell them that if you ever wake up some morning and you have passion as a married person at a 10 out of 10, you have intimacy at a 10 out of 10, you have commitment at a 10 out of 10, and you roll over to your partner and he or she has all three of these ingredients at a 10 out of 10, I will tell them, I have some advice for you. Take the day off work. It's going to be a good day. Right? But you can't expect to wake up every morning of your married love life and have all three of these ingredients at a 10 out of 10. Why? Because the bottom line is love is very, very fluid.
One of the reasons love is so fluid is our relationships have a certain cycle that we go through. And as our relationships sort of get deeper, we go through some really predictable experiences and jolts with one another. Now, one of the things you guys all know is when you're first attracted to someone, when you start a relationship, when that relationship sparks, you are having the most incredible feelings of intimacy and passion for them. And you know what? It's because we really do idealize people that we meet, and we realize they have qualities that we respect and we admire. This is someone I want to know. And immediately we just idealize them like crazy. And relationships all start there. We idealize each other because that's just part of what the beginning of a relationship is. And when you see somebody who seems to have the qualities you admire, you just begin to imagine this fabulous person, and you kind of fill in the blanks. You know what I mean? It's kind of like a picture that's not complete. And in your mind, it's like you take that same projector slide that I talked about this morning, and you just project a slide onto them that completes the picture, and you fill it in with everything you love and admire, and you just see that. You see those qualities in them, whether they've got them or not. It's just a part of the beginning of a relationship. We all know, you guys know that, you're familiar with that euphoria that you get when you idealize someone. One of the things you may not know and have identified is that usually in relationships, as you kind of carry on, get to know someone a little bit better, you move into the next phase of relationship pretty predictably, and this is the phase I call monstrousizing them. Okay? Because in the beginning, you idealize them and you project those wonderful qualities onto them when you just see a little bit of it. But as you move on in the relationship, you begin to see some things that give you evidence. They may not be everything that is a dream come true for you. And you might see a little quality. And then when you see that, you go, whoa, back up. This person may be terrible. Maybe I really missed the ball. You know, maybe I totally missed it on them. Didn't get it. I just didn't get it. I didn't know what they were about. And they're even worse than I could have ever have imagined. And you do that with certain qualities. Now, let me give you a little illustration, tell you what I mean by that. As we move through these steps together, one of the things about us is that we did date forever. I mean, we dated for 7 years. That's a long time. We dated, started dating in high school, dated all the way through college. We finally married after college. Well, we had a lot of time to go through some cycles together. All of those years together, 7 years, college side by side, we'd go to chapel, you know, 3 times a week together. We'd go to church on Sunday morning, go to church on Sunday night. We had all this time side by side. Somehow, throughout that entire experience, in all of the idealizing Les did of me, he really had believed, without ever saying it out loud, that I had a lovely singing voice. I mean, that was just something he thought. He just imagined that someone that he would be so drawn to and would think was beautiful and wonderful would also have an incredible singing voice. Now, I don't know where he got that, but he did. He imagined that. And here we were. I mean, we'd have hymnals out together. What I didn't know, you know, until many years later on, is he would be kind of shy. He wouldn't kind of sing along with the choruses beside me. He was real intimidated to sing next to me because I was an incredible singer, he thought. So here we are. We're going throughout, I mean, years together. We're talking years. Now, soon after we were married, we took off on a road trip together in this old Ford pickup truck that we had with, you know, no air conditioning. We were going across the desert in California. We had the windows rolled down, and we cranked up the radio, and I'm singing along with one of my favorite songs, and, you know, drinking pop and the whole thing. And all of a sudden, Les just reaches over and turns the radio off. And I'm thinking, what are you doing? That's my song. And I turn it back on, and I'm singing along real loud, and then he just reaches back over and turns it off. And then he just kind of has this look on his face, and I say, what? He's like, you know, you're completely ruining that song. And I said, I am? And he said, yeah, you're not even singing it with the right tune. And I said, well, you know, I do that. I can't sing. And I mean, he was completely shocked at that. I am not kidding. He was shocked at that. He really thought I had a beautiful voice. The truth is, I cannot carry a tune in a bucket. Never have, never. I mean, I've never been able to sing. I don't know where he got that. But he did. He had idealized me in that way. He had a picture in his mind about who I was. I wasn't that person at all.
I think something happened to her vocal cords after we got married. I'm not sure. I can't prove it. But.
So what happened then he's like, you know, he didn't mean to be rude about it at all, but he was irritated. You know how that kind of stuff can kind of get on your nerves? And you start thinking, oh my goodness, if she's hidden this from me, what else has she hidden? You know, and you start imagining all these horrible things that might be true about this person you're in a relationship with. Well, we do that. We kind of monstrosize people. Now, if you have the maturity in a relationship to hang in there and you work through that idealization, and when those bubbles get burst and you realize they're not everything you would dream they would be, then you have to kind of go through the experience where you realize there may be more to this picture than you've seen, but if you hang in there with that person and you really invest and you're mature enough to take the time and get to know who they really are, not the idealized version, not that monstrous-sized version now that you're terrified they might be, but the real person, the mixture of good and bad, you know, the qualities they have that are terrific, the qualities they have that need to be refined, if you stay in that relationship long enough, then you have genuine intimacy because you get to enjoy and know the real person that you're in a relationship with. And that takes time. You've got to move through those phases. And sometimes you have to move through those phases time and again in your relationship as you move to deeper and deeper levels before you really know, is this a real person that I can be in a relationship with and really deeply connect with? Is this the person for me? And it takes moving through those phases before you come to that place of safety and knowledge that this is the real person that I'm getting to know in the relationship.
Well, idealize, monstrosize, and then realize.
Right.
Those three phases again and again. What that sometimes looks like, in fact, if you look at it within the small context of relationship, you know, we idealize somebody up here, and man, they're great. It's a 10 out of 10. I mean, this is fabulous. And just over the course of time, it seems like it hits an all-time low, and you can't believe that. But as Leslie says, if you come out of the monstrosizing to realizing, it comes back up here again at a 10 out of 10, or at least has the potential to do that, although it might fluctuate. And then what's very interesting is if you look at love over the lifespan, and you interview couples.
That's right.
How's your love life? In fact, you go to a newlywed couple. We had dinner tonight with several newlywed couples. I guarantee you, if I were to survey them, ask them, how is your love life? Those are in the first few even weeks of their marriage. What are they going to tell you on a scale of 1 to 10? How's your love life? What are they going to tell you? It's 10. Doesn't get any better than this. This is great, right? This is what we've been living for. This is fabulous. We're crazy in love, right? They wouldn't be getting married if they weren't at that level. Now, you come back a year later, 2 years later, 3 years later, you ask this couple, how's your love life? What are they going to tell you? Scale 1 to 10. Yeah, about 7. It's not quite what it used to be. It's come down just a little bit. You come back and ask them 6 years later, 8 years later, what are they going to tell you? What are they going to tell you? Yeah, it's not quite as good as it used to be. It's kind of hit some tough times here. 12 years later, 15 years later, 20 years later, we know this from research. That, friends, I don't want to scare you because this I know looks very scary. This is the typical course of love on average in our society for a couple's love life. Right? Looks kind of scary, I know. Right? And now we also know that the vast majority of divorces these days happens right there and right here. In fact, we're seeing a huge increase in divorces right there where it's kind of the empty nest syndrome for mom and dad, and they've held it together for their kids, and now they're fracturing. Now, this is sad for a variety of reasons, and one of them is these couples are missing out on the best part of love, because what we also know from research is you come back and you ask those couples over the years, how's your love life now? And they've been working on it, and it begins to increase, and it gets higher and higher. And research has actually shown it goes off the charts. The level of passion and intimacy and commitment, they can't even measure anymore. In fact, I got to tell you, we have a prime witness to it, a prime example, sitting right down here on the front row. This couple that made this whole thing possible, been married for 50 years, can testify to it. It just supersedes the level of love they had when they first got married. For these couples that learn to cultivate passion, right? Remember the three ingredients of love? What's the first one? Number two is? Number three is? Right? Those three ingredients. Now, anybody here ever been on a whitewater rafting trip? Oh, you'll understand this. I went on my first whitewater rafting trip not too long ago, a few years ago. And, boy, we were excited about this. Some of my buddies from school, where I teach, some other faculty and so forth, we decided we're going to do this whitewater rafting trip. And here we are, grown men. We are so excited about this trip. I mean, the level of anticipation could not have been higher. We were planning our trip and even talking about the kinds of candy bars we were going to bring with us on this trip. That was the level of, you know, let's bring Reese's. Yeah, Reese's. You know, it was that kind of talk. And we had brochures that had different kinds of river trips that we could go on, different companies in eastern Washington where we live. And we were looking them over, and we couldn't make up our mind. And then one of us discovered, well, hey, man, this trip comes with a barbecue dinner. Well, enough said. That's the one we're going on, right? And so we all pay our money, and we mail it in. We meet our river guide out there, and we're staying around getting ready for this trip, ready to just hop in the boat. And he said, well, first of all, we got to talk through some things. And he gave us wetsuits to put on. He said, this time of the year, this season, it's going to be very cold. You want to wear these wetsuits. We put those on. We're kind of making fun of how we look in them, kind of funny. And then he hands each one of us a helmet, and we start to put these helmets on, and then we start to look at each other, and we're going, why are we wearing helmets? You know, nobody on the brochure was wearing any helmets. Why is this group wearing a helmet? And he said, well, for insurance purposes, this kind of river, it's just required you have to wear a helmet. And we said, what do you mean this kind of river? And that's when we all learned that they rank the difficulty of these rivers. Do you guys know this? We didn't know this, all right? They ranked it, and this one was ranked near the top in level of difficulty. And it had turns in it known as the meat grinder and, you know, stuff like that. And all we knew is it came with a barbecue dinner, okay? That's the only reason we were there. And so here we are. We pile into this boat, and we get out there. And by the way, before he does that, he says one thing. He says when the boat tips over, he says one of the things that you're going to want to do is lean back, put your feet forward, and your feet will serve as kind of a shock absorber against the jagged boulders ahead of you, and it'll protect the rest of your body. And we're going, oh, okay, you know, that's very comforting. And he said, the other thing is it's very slippery on that boat. He said, make sure you have a buddy that's going to kind of help you to get back into the boat. And, you know, we're looking at each other, you're going to be my buddy, man? You're going to be my buddy? And kind of the level of anxiety is starting to rise around this riverbank. Anyway, it comes time to hop into this boat. I don't know what my friends are thinking at this time, but I'm thinking to myself, okay, I don't care if this boat flips over 30 times. I'm not letting go of the boat. I'm just going to hold on to this rope that's right here in front of me. Now, if you've ever done one of these, you know it doesn't work that way because the guy that you pay all the money to, the guide, he sits in the back of the boat, he gives you an oar, and he proceeds to yell at you for the rest of the day, right? More on the left, more on the right, and so forth. I remember around noontime on this trip, I had this buzzing headache. My muscles were aching sore. My body was freezing cold, and yet my face was sunburned. I was so miserable. We'd fallen out of the boat I don't know how many times. And it was just, and by the way, that thing about leaning back and helping your buddy, no, forget that. It's every man for himself when this thing trips over. And I can remember saying to myself, I got to get out of this. This is miserable. I did not sign up for that. I can't believe I pay good money to come out here and feel this miserable. I want out of this thing, you know. Well, if you've done this, you know you can't get out of it. You're in the middle of this river. You have to proceed. You've got to keep going. And so we did, and we finally got to that campsite that night, and they had that barbecue dinner already prepared, and the campfire was there, and we're pounding this stuff down, enjoying the barbecue dinner. And you think that tasted good, by the way, that barbecue dinner? Tastes good? Anything tastes good after a day like that. I don't know it could have been fried wrap for all I know, but it tasted good, you know. Anything after a day of working that hard tastes pretty good. After we enjoyed that meal, then they brought out three ingredients: marshmallows, chocolate bars, graham crackers, and we had s'mores. Is there anything better, you know? We couldn't make these things fast enough, and we got an assembly line going. We're making them, and then one of my buddies, he discovered you could make them with Reese's peanut butter cups. Unbelievable. And we're just enjoying these things. Now, what do you think the conversation was like around that dinner table, or around that campfire, rather? I think I was the first one to say it, and I said, guys, it doesn't get any better than this. We got to do this more often. I think this is one of the best days I've ever had. Really? Remember when I fell out of the boat and you guys wouldn't let me in? That was so hilarious. Here I was romanticizing this trip that earlier I would have done anything in the world to get out of it, you know? And here I was just hours later looking back on it going, this is great. Okay, so we had some tough time back there, but man, this is great. This has been a day I will always... Now, I don't want to stretch the metaphor too far, but sometimes your love life can be like that. And you start off up here and all this eager anticipation, isn't this great? And you've idealized this person and, oh, they can do no wrong. Isn't it wonderful? And then you journey through, you cross that proverbial threshold of marriage and you journey through a little bit of white water. You didn't know it was going to be like this. And you come down into here and there's even more white water and the boat turns over and you need a helmet and that wasn't on the marriage brochure. And, you know, the good news for every couple that learns to cultivate three ingredients. Do you remember what the first one is? Remember what the first one is? Number two is? Number three is? The good news for those couples is more time is coming, right? It's right up here. Now, here's the really good news.
Right.
Here's the really good news. You don't have to go through this at all. This is what, so if you take a course in marriage on this campus and you open up, if you have a standard textbook here, and it looks at marital satisfaction over the lifespan, you're going to find this chart in there, okay? It's just standard. This is what society as a whole we're looking at. But if you were to look at individuals, well, we don't follow this track at all. Everybody seems to find their own path on this. And the good news is for those couples that have their heads on straight, that think correctly about love and realize it takes work and that commitment is what carries you through when the passion isn't there and the intimacy isn't there and so forth, you don't have to go through this at all.
Right.
You can't expect it to be at a 10 out of 10 all the time. But you don't expect it to go through that.
And I think that's the whole point. If you really understand what love is and that these are the ingredients of love and that they have an ebb and flow to them, you know, like the tide, then whenever you don't feel passionate at a 10 out of a 10 or you're not saying, wow, the intimacy is a 10 out of a 10, you don't feel guilty about it. You don't get anxious about it. Instead, you just take ownership for it and say, hey, you know, we're experiencing the natural ebb and flow of love. What do we need to do right now in our relationship to cultivate those things and bring them back to a place of real fullness again together? How can we take that project on? And when you don't feel guilty and you're not anxious because you're smart about what real love is, it allows you the freedom to do the work you need to have your love be a high quality and wonderful experience all the way throughout your life together.
And I don't know how you do that, by the way, without the help of the Holy Spirit
right.
in your life. I don't know how other couples can do it without God in their life to make that happen. Let me tell you before we wrap this thing up. You still hanging in there? Another 5 minutes or not? We can end right now if you need to.
Yeah.
5 minutes? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay, that's pretty good. One of the things that I don't think is understood by most people when it comes to the love life is that there is a silent saboteur, something that I call love's unseen enemy, that will sabotage your love life without you even knowing it. It's a particular emotion, as I said, I call it love's unseen enemy, and it's an emotion that you've all heard of, and you wouldn't be thinking of it in this way, but it's guilt. Guilt. I want to show you what I mean by this. Guilt. I think that guilt, more than any other single emotion that we humans experience, rips the heart out of our love life. The emotion of guilt. Who makes you feel most guilty? Well, the people that you love the most. Guilt is a part of every relationship, and it's a part of every relationship, first of all, because it works. Right? If you want somebody to do something right now, put a little bit of guilt on their back. They're more likely to do it. By the way, if you want somebody to have a general lifestyle of doing that same thing, don't use guilt, because it'll backfire on you, right? In fact, every pastor knows this. If you want to raise a little bit more offering in the plates this Sunday, put a little more guilt on your people. If you want to have a generous spirit ongoing, don't use guilt. Doesn't work. You know that passage of Scripture, God loves a guilty giver? It's found in First Confusions. You know, you've read it, right? God loves what kind of giver? Cheerful, right? When we do the right thing for the wrong reasons, we're doing it out of guilt. The right thing for the right reason, that's what we're looking for. And let me just show you very quickly how this works. I'm going to just do this so quick. I did this study of more than 1,000 people, actually all church-going people around the country. I wanted to understand how does guilt impact their capacity to love. And I started by giving them a measure of love. You ask people questions. Would you rather be quick-witted or compassionate? Would you rather be sensitive or well-organized? You know, you ask a bunch of questions like that, put in some buffer items. You don't know where what they're trying to get at. I divided them right down the middle. I got people that have a lot of love. They really value love. They're high on love. And then people that are low on love. These are people really prize love. These are people that aren't selfish necessarily. It's just that love isn't the most important thing in their life. I gave that same group of people a measure of guilt. And here I'm talking about guilt, by the way, as an emotion, as a feeling, not as a condition or a state that we're born into, but as a psychological emotion. Divided them right down the middle. Got people that really carry around a big sack of guilt, high on guilt, and people that are low on guilt. These people up here, high on guilt, they've been carrying around a big backpack filled with guilt about a variety of things all day long, sometimes all week long, sometimes most of their lives, you know, and they just carry that guilt around. These people down here, they're able to breathe deep. It's not that they're carrying around guilt about anything, and just a totally different perspective on this emotion. Now, here's what I discovered. I said, I don't think there's going to be anybody in this quadrant out of these 1,000 people I was surveying. I don't think there'll be anybody up here that's high on guilt and high on love. I said, they'll cancel each other out. I said that it just doesn't make sense. And I gave this survey, got the information back. Guess what? I could not have been more wrong. More people in this quadrant high on guilt and high on love than any other single quadrant. I call these people pleasers. Pleasers. Do you know a pleaser? These people are so eager to meet your needs, sometimes they'll meet needs you don't even have. They're eager to please. What I discovered about pleasers is that they're lacking a very important component of love. They have half of what it takes to love another person. Because these people love with their hearts, but they don't love with their heads. In other words, these people will sympathize, but they won't analyze. These people, oh, they feel your pain, but they lack that capacity to stand back objectively and go, I know how I'd feel if I were in your shoes, but I'm not you. Let me check this out with you. Is this what you're going through? They just jump to conclusions, and that's why I said they try to sometimes meet your need when you don't even have those needs. Somebody told me I should call this quadrant sloppy agape. Doesn't that make sense? Because it looks like they're loving, The problem is they aren't always loving because they're not meeting real needs. They're really meeting their own needs by meeting yours to feel better about themselves, to get that guilt off their back. Because the more loving they feel, the less guilty they feel. And so they just continue in this cycle. Now let me tell you about the mirror image of the pleaser down here, low on guilt and low on love. This is a group of people I call controllers. Controllers. And these people, they really are the mirror image of the pleaser. They're low on guilt, first of all, not carrying around a big sack of guilt. And they don't value love as much as other people might. And what I discovered here is just the opposite of the pleaser. They have half of what it takes to be a loving person. These people love with their heads, but not with their hearts. These people will analyze a situation, but they have a tough time sympathizing with a situation. So guess what? If you're looking for a shoulder to cry on, who do you want to find, a pleaser or a controller? You want a pleaser. They got all the time in the world for you. Oh, they feel your pain. They're there with you. You take a problem to a controller, and what do? They solve it for you, right? They'll give you three easy solutions to make your whole world better, and then they're ready for lunch, right? They just solve that problem. They'll give me another one, right? They're pretty good at that. It's kind of like, you remember Tom Sawyer? You all read that book in high school, and he had to paint that fence, had to whitewash that fence, and he sees his buddies coming down the lane. What's he do? Analyze the situation. I bet those guys are bored. I bet they're looking for something to do. What are you doing, Tom? Oh, hey, guys, I'm having a great time. I get to paint this fence today. Really? What's that like? Oh, you ought to try, right? They're pretty good. He's pretty good at getting his own needs met, and so are controllers. Good at getting their own needs met. Now, you remember the sentence I gave you this morning? The one sentence I said could revolutionize your relationships? If you try to build intimacy with another person before you've done the hard work of getting whole or healthy on your own, not that you've arrived, but you're in the process of doing that, all your relationships become an attempt to complete yourself. Well, guess what happens for these two people in relationships? And by the way, I can tell you with a fair degree of certainty that the vast majority of you in this congregation right here fit into these two groups. And I'd say that just about half of you are pleasers and half of you are controllers. Do you know who you are? You think there's a gender difference here? More women or more men up here? More women. More men or more women? More men, right? So it only makes sense that when it comes to our love life that we see relationships that look like that. And as I said, you remember the sentence, looking for wholeness. Well, this guy's walking around this campus going, I need a heart. She's got a heart. I'll lean on her. Remember the A-frame relationship? And that's what happens for these people. They create this A-frame relationship. Well, she needs to be more analytical. So she'll count on him to do that. And they'll become whole. They'll become complete. You complete me. Right? Well, there's an alternative to both of these, and I want to tell you about it, and I've got to do this very quickly. Up here, by the way, I'll just tell you about this quadrant, because this is a totally different situation. This is where you'll find a group of people I call withholders. Withholders. And by the way, these are people, it takes a lot of patience to be in a relationship with a withholder. Low on love and high on guilt. These are people that have been burned in a relationship before, and they don't want to get burned again. They've been hurt by somebody, and they aren't going to take the risk of getting hurt again. And like I said, it just takes a lot of patience to be with this person. Their theme song is, "What Have You Done For Me Lately?" Right? It's almost like this person is wearing a pair of mirrored sunglasses, and they've taken the lenses out, and they flipped them around, and they put them back in the frames. And they walk around the planet and they look at other people and all they see is a reflection of their own needs. You ever seen somebody like that? It takes a lot of patience to be with somebody like that. In fact, one of the courses I teach at the university where I work is a course in personal growth. And one of the fundamental things I try to help my freshmen do on this campus is to make a shift in attitude from being able to walk into a room and no longer say, "Hey, how am I doing?" Because that's what we all do, especially in adolescence. You know, that's where we should be, 15, 16, 17 years old. We walk in a room and we're checking ourselves out everywhere I go. What do you guys think, man? How am I doing? You like the tie? I can't tell. The hair? I don't know. A little funny today. You guys like me? I can't tell. I'm not getting a read here. You like me or not? Right? I can't tell. Give me some kind of signal here. Do you guys like me or not? I'm looking for the signal. I don't see any signal at all. This is getting really scary for me, right? That's adolescence. That's what it's like. Literally, that's what's going on inside of us. We're checking ourselves out everywhere we go. What do people think of me? Right? It's like those mirrored sunglasses. I try to help them make a fundamental shift to walking into a room and no longer saying, how am I doing? But instead saying, how are you doing? How are you doing? When you do that, you're on your way to maturity. Well, these people have a hard time doing that. Do you want to know what's in this final quadrant? Yes or no?
Yes.
All right, here we go. You guys are quiet. Did I scare you? It's a quiet group. In this final quadrant, you're going to find a group of people I call the genuine lovers. And this is the whole point. The genuine lovers. Low on guilt, high on love. This is the only place you're going to find a person that knows how to love with their head as well as their heart, that can sympathize as well as analyze. This is the person that has the heart of love. And what is the heart of love? In a single word, it's empathy. In a single word, the heart of love is empathy. I don't know of anybody that can have a successful love life without a big dose of empathy in that relationship. What is empathy? That capacity to see the world from another person's perspective, to put yourself in their shoes and imagine what life must be like. That's empathy. It's a rare, rare thing. And by the way, that's what God gave us in His Son, Christ, when He came to this planet to put Himself in our place. Empathy. It's the ultimate gift of love. When was the last time you did that for somebody else? When was the last time you used both your head and your heart to see the world as somebody else sees it? When you did, that's love. When was the last time somebody did that for you? Well, that's when you received love. It's a rare gift. It really is. And we get it so confused. You know, sympathy, we equate with it. It's not. In fact, I tell my counseling students at home, I say that sympathy is standing on the shore and throwing out a life ring to somebody struggling in the water. Everybody in this room would do that. That's sympathy. It flows. I believe we should do the same thing with people that are trying to be loving to one another. Empathy. It is such a gift. It's the heart of love. Well, do you want to talk briefly about the gender differences on this, or should we wrap things up?
We should probably wrap it up.
All right. Let's wrap it up. Do you guys want to wrap it up?
Really? You guys are still hanging in there? Not getting sleepy on this, are you? Okay. All right. Why don't you tell them about the communication styles, then I'll talk about the gender differences.
Real quick. Communications. I knew we were going to lose people. Look at this guy's leaving on the front row. He probably needs it more than anybody else on this campus, too. That's what I'm guessing. The pleaser, literally, take five more minutes?
Sure,
do you
less.
Think? I already asked less. Him for five, less I'll than just... five. Pleasers have a style of communication that is one of deferring. They like to defer in conversation. Where do you want to go for dinner? Well, I don't care, wherever you want to go. Well, I always choose the restaurant. Why don't you choose one? No, I like whatever you like. Please, for once in your life, just choose a restaurant. No. Why do they defer? Why do they like to defer? Because if they make the decision, there's more potential for guilt, right? The withholder has a style not of deferring, but of defecting. Where do you want to go for dinner? I don't care. Well, how about pizza? I know you like pizza, I guess. Well, let's get a pizza. What do you say? Whatever, right? You ever had that conversation? They defer, they defect. The controller, they demand. Where do you want to go for dinner? Seafood, get in the car, let's go. By the way, I just finished writing a book that will come out here in just another couple months, and it's called The Control Freak. And I wrote a book a little while ago called High Maintenance Relationships, and that did pretty well and went on Barbara Walters and Oprah and all that stuff with it, and the publisher got so excited about it, they said, let's do a follow-up. And so we did this book called The Control Freak. I came home the night after signing that contract to write that book. I told Leslie, hey, I'm writing a book called The Control Freak. Without skipping a beat, she said, oh, that's good news. finally, you're writing your autobiography. There's some truth in it. The controller, pleasers, defer, defect, demand, declare. They know how to make a declarative statement. These people are so easy to live with. Where do you want to go for dinner? I'm kind of in the mood for seafood, but I could be talking to something else. How about you? Not a bad way to live. Talk about easy to live with.
All right, let's just take a minute and talk about some of these gender dynamics, because what Les said is true. Really, the majority of women tend to be in that pleaser quadrant, and the majority of men tend to be in that controller quadrant. And so it really does set up some interesting conversations when you're trying to establish intimacy and dating relationships. What happens is you can be a fabulous friend. You can be a great communicator in all your other relationships. When it comes to that sort of romantic relationship where you're in conversations, things don't go as well as you would expect them to. You kind of get mysterious and you're a little more puzzled. And I'll tell you why. Because pleasers and controllers have really different expectations of a conversation. When a couple of pleasers, a couple of women, have a conversation, in fact, you might even notice it like between classes or maybe after chapel sometimes, and you're talking out, you know, out in the foyer of your great chapel. When women are talking together, what do? I mean, they gaze into each other's eyes, you know. In fact, do you notice women kind of hold hands while they're talking even? You notice, you know, like on church on Sunday, people hold hands, and they're just staring into each other's eyes, and what are they talking about? I mean, you could walk up 30 seconds after they connect, and they're not saying what they did today. They're saying, I'm so depressed today, and I really need you to pray for me about this, or whatever it is. I mean, they are oceans deep, 30 seconds. They're right there to the deepest feeling they've got going in their life. I mean, they're going to put it right out there, because for a couple of pleasers whose heart is the way they approach life, the whole point of a conversation is to do something that sociologist Deborah Tannen calls build rapport. And that's to build an emotional bond of connection right here, right now. The whole point of this conversation is I want to be sure of this relationship. I want to know we're connected. Doesn't even matter what we say to each other. I want to walk away and realize in my heart, you're connected to me. We're good friends, or we're soulmates, or we're in love. I want that feeling. In fact, you know, one of the great things about being a new mom is I'm reading all these old classic children's stories. And the other day I was reading a book, a Winnie the Pooh story. And I'm reading it to John, and I turned to Les and I said, did you get a load of this here? Listen to what I just read. And it was a conversation between Winnie the Pooh and Piglet. And Piglet says, Pooh? And Pooh says, what, Piglet? And he says, oh, nothing. I just wanted to be sure of you. I said, that's it. That's what women want in a conversation. You know, they just want to be sure that you're there, that it's not even the content. I just want to be sure you love me, that you know I'm here, that we're really connected. That's what a couple of pleasers do. That's their whole goal in the conversation. Build rapport. Get connected. They're coming at it with their hearts. Now, do you think a couple of controllers have that style of a conversation? Really looks different. I heard someone say no. Listen, I got to tell you know, Les confessed already that he's kind of a classic in this way. He does tend to operate more out of this controller quadrant. The other day, I watched him have a conversation with one of his buddies after church on a Sunday morning. He has this great friend, Merle Carner. He's been like a police detective in the Seattle area for about 23 years, and he's one of these guys that started the Crime Stopper show, real interesting guy. And so Les is always excited to see him when we get to be in town on a Sunday. And so I walked up behind him. They did not know I was standing there. I just observed their conversation while they talked together. And they had one of these conversations that would be very typical for a couple of controllers. Merle and Les both got out their day timers. Do you guys carry day timers? Now, Les doesn't just have a day timer. He has something called a Palm Pilot. You know, it's a computerized day timer. Do you guys have those? And we're talking a day timer extraordinaire. And so they both had their day timers out. They're looking at their day timers. They don't even glance at each other, not the whole time. And I hear Merle, he tells us everything he's done in the last few weeks since they've seen each other, and then he tells them what's coming up in the next couple weeks. And then Les does the same thing, goes, Merle, that sounds great. Here's what I've done. Here's where I'm going to be in the next couple weeks. Then I'm just standing there watching. They slapped each other on the back, and then they turned around, and they walked away from each other. Les turns, he sees me, and he goes, oh, Leslie, hi. Just talking to Merle. It was great to see Merle. And I said, you got to be kidding me. You guys never even looked at each other. You didn't see Merle, you know. But let me tell you what.
It's because the thing she'd like me to say is, come up from her own, go, Merle, and he'd go, yes, Les. And I'd go, oh, nothing. I just wanted to be sure of you.
That's when they'd really be living, when they did that. Now, listen. When a couple of controllers, or most of the time men, in fact, it's such a men's style of conversation that sociologists call it, the style of conversation men tend to have is called report talk. Okay? It's about giving and receiving information. It's not about, I just want to be sure of you. It's not about an emotional bond, a connection. It's about, if I care about you, give me the information. I want to know what's going on in your life, and I'll give you the information about my life. Now, do you think that takes looking in each other's eyes? No. I mean, you could have a newspaper spread across your face. You can be sitting in the stadium watching a sports event. You can be doing anything. You don't have to be gazing, because you're not trying to bond so much as you're trying to share information about each other. Give the report and get the report. That's how you show you care about somebody. Now, what happens in our relationships when we're dating is one of us is coming with a conversation, hey, I'm going to give you my report, get your report, we'll be updated on each other. The other person wants the emotional connection. And so sometimes that conversation can really be confusing and break down. You don't know what's going on. How come we're both great at connecting in our friendships, but when we try to talk sometimes, it doesn't go the place we really wanted it to go or expected it to go. And that's sometimes what happens when we, instead of operating out of that genuinely loving quadrant with our heart and our head, we get stuck in those quadrants, get separated from each other, and have a harder time making a connection because we're only using the heart or only using the head in that conversation.
So remember, love is built on three ingredients: passion, intimacy, and commitment. And when all else fails, put yourself in the other person's shoes. Thanks very much.